Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 55. It's July 15th, 2020. Try again, fail again, fail better. Samuel Beckett. Any discussion about the skill acquiring process must begin by addressing a curious phenomenon that I came to know as the Holy S effect. This refers to the heady mix of disbelief, admiration, and envy, not necessarily in that order, we feel when talent suddenly appears out of nowhere. The HSE is not the feeling of hearing Pavarotti sing or watching Willie Mays swing. They're one in a billion. We can easily accept the fact that they're different from us. The HSE is the feeling of seeing talent bloom in people who we thought were just like us. It's the tingle of surprise you get when the goofy neighbor kid down the street is suddenly lead guitarist for a successful rock band, or when your own child shows an inexplicable knack for differential calculus. It's the feeling of, where did that come from? Traveling to talent hotbeds, I became plenty familiar with the HSE. First, I would see young, cuddly kids, just like my kids, trundling along to their classes, toting their cute baseball bats and tiny violins, making clumsy, endearing attempts at skill. They were just as unimpressive as you would expect children of that age to be. Then, as the youngest kids departed and older kids started showing up, I witnessed a series of quantum leaps in skill level. Spending a few days at a hotbed was like walking down the hallway of a museum exhibition on the rise of the dinosaur. As if passing a series of dioramas, I encountered increasingly evolved species. Pre-teens, who were pretty darn good. The mid-teens, wow. And finally, the older teenagers, who were velociraptors. Take cover. The speed of the progression was stunning. Each successive group was unimaginably stronger, faster, and more ferociously talented than the previous. Watching the change was like seeing an adorable gecko lizard morph into a slavering T-Rex. You know the two are related in theory, but that knowledge doesn't stop you from saying, holy S. The interesting thing about the HSE is that it operates in one direction. The observer is dumbstruck, amazed, and bewildered, while the talent's owner is unsurprised, even blasé. This trick-mirror quality is not merely a case of diverging impressions, of willful naivete on the observer's part, or undue modesty on the talent holder's part. It is a consistent perceptual pattern at the core of the skill-acquiring process, and it raises an important question. What's the nature of this process that creates two such wildly divergent realities? How can these people, who seem just like us, suddenly become talented, while barely cognizant of how talented they've become? For the answer, we turn to a failed math teacher named Adrian Dingman de Groot. De Groot, who was born in 1914, was a Dutch psychologist who played chess in his spare time. He experienced his own version of the HSE when a handful of players from his chess club, people just like him in age, experience, and background, nevertheless were able to perform superhuman feats of chess mastery. These were the sort of T-Rex players who could casually destroy 10 opponents at once, blindfolded. Like Anders Ericsson decades later, De Groot puzzled over his losses, which led him to ask, what exactly made these guys so great? At the time, the scientific wisdom on the issue was unquestioned. It held that the best players possessed photographic memories that they used to absorb information and plan strategies. Master players succeeded, the theory went, because they were endowed with the cognitive equivalent of cannons, while the rest of us made do with pop guns. But De Groot didn't buy this theory. He wanted to find out more. To investigate, he set up an experiment involving both master players and more ordinary ones. De Groot placed chess pieces into positions from a real game, gave the players a 5-second glimpse of the board, and then tested their recall. The results were what one might expect. The master players recalled the pieces and arrangements 4 to 5 times better than the ordinary players did. World-class players neared 100% recall. Then De Groot did something clever. Instead of using patterns from a real chess game, he set the chess pieces in a random arrangement and re-ran the test. Suddenly, the master's advantage vanished. They scored no better than lesser players. In one case, a master chess player did worse than a novice. The master players didn't have photographic memories. When the game stopped resembling chess, their skills evaporated. De Groot went on to show that in the first test, the masters were not seeing individual chess pieces, but recognizing patterns. Where novices saw a scattered alphabet of individual pieces, masters were grouping those letters into the chess equivalent of words, sentences, and paragraphs. When the pieces became random, the masters were lost. Not because they suddenly became dumber, but because their grouping strategy was suddenly useless. The HSE vanished. The difference between chess, T-Rexes, and ordinary players was not the difference between a cannon and a pop gun. It was a difference of organization. The difference between someone who understood a language and someone who didn't. Or to put it another way, the difference between an experienced baseball fan who can take in a game with an ascertaining glance, runner on third, two out, bottom of the seventh inning, and the same fan at his first cricket match who spends the game squinting baffledly. Skill consists of identifying important elements and grouping them into a meaningful framework. The name psychologists use for such organization is chunking. To get a feel for how chunking works, try to memorize these two sentences. We climbed Mount Everest on a Tuesday morning. Gn in Ramya Desut Anatsur Ev A Tanound Bilmu. The two sentences contain the same letters, just like De Groot's chessboards, except in the second sentence, the order of those letters is reversed. The reason you can understand, recall, and manipulate the first sentence is that, like the chess masters or baseball fans, you spent many hours learning and practicing a cognitive game known as reading. You've learned letter shapes and practiced chunking letters from left to right into discrete entities with deeper meanings, words. And you've learned how to group those into still bigger chunks, sentences, that you can handle, move around, understand, and remember. The first sentence is easy to remember because it has only three main conceptual chunks. We climbed is a chunk, Mount Everest is a chunk, and Tuesday morning is a chunk. Those chunks are in turn composed of smaller chunks. The letters W and E are both chunks that you combine into another chunk called we. The pattern of four diagonal lines forms a still smaller chunk that you recognize as a W, and so on. Each group of chunks nests neatly inside another group like so many sets of Russian dolls. Your skill at reading, at its essence, is the skill of packing and unpacking chunks, of firing patterns of circuits at lightning speed. Chunking is a strange concept. The idea that skill, which is graceful, fluid, and seemingly effortless, should be created by the nested accumulation of small discrete circuits seems counterintuitive to say the least. But a massive body of scientific research shows that this is precisely the way skills are built. And not just for cognitive pursuits like chess. Physical acts are also built of chunks. When a gymnast learns a floor routine, he assembles it via a series of chunks, which in turn are made up of other chunks. He's grouped a series of muscle movements together in exactly the same way that you grouped a series of letters together to form Everest. The fluency happens when the gymnast repeats the movements often enough that he knows how to process those chunks as one big chunk, the same way that you process the above sentence. When he fires his circuits to do a backflip, the gymnast doesn't have to think, okay, I'm going to push off with my legs, arc my back, tuck my head into my shoulders, and bring my hips around, any more than you have to process each letter of Tuesday. He simply fires the backflip circuit that he's built and honed through deep practice. When chunking has been done effectively, it creates a mirage that gives rise to the HSE. From below, top performers look incomprehensibly superior, as if they've leaped in a single bound across a huge chasm. Yet as De Groot showed, they aren't nearly so different from ordinary performers as they seem. What separates these two levels is not innate superpower, but a slowly accrued act of construction and organization. The building of scaffolding, bolt by bolt and circuit by circuit, wrap by wrap. Pretty cool. I'm tempted just to keep reading, but I think I'll stop for now. This is somewhere in the middle of The Talent Code, a book by Daniel Coyle. The subtitle, Greatness Isn't Born, It's Grown, Here's How. It's a really cool book. He followed this, I think, with Culture Code. It certainly came out later. I'm not sure if he had other books in between. But Culture Code is also a great read. I'll get to it eventually. To give you a sense of some of the headings that follow in this chapter, Rule 1, Chunk It Up, a whole section called Absorb the Whole Thing, Break It Into Chunks, Slow It Down, Rule 2, Repeat It, and then Rule 3, Learn to Feel It. It's just a really good read. It provides tons of food for thought and a great framework. I like, too, the story of De Groot not accepting the conventional wisdom and actually testing it, and very importantly, not just running one test. The first test, where he just merely tested the recall of novice versus exceptional chess players when glancing at a board or looking at it for 5 seconds, testing their recall. That's one test, and it showed that the experienced chess players performed far better, five times plus better than the others. But then also that super helpful to come back at the same topic, scramble the board, and then realize that it's not memory alone, it's contextualized memory. And I love too, then he goes to language and forces us to experience in reading the book a sentence and then that sentence reversed, and how impossible it is to remember the second sentence because it's just a big scramble. And of course, as a baseball fan from earliest memory, I can completely identify. To this day, if I try to watch cricket, I would love to understand cricket, and probably I need to go YouTube and dive through some explainer videos and understand what's going on. But when I look at that, I have absolutely no idea what's happening. But I can glance at a baseball game and understand exactly where we are, and the box score and the back of a baseball card are some of the finest artifacts ever created to depict the action and reduce it into a way and scoring a baseball game and all that kind of stuff. I know that from the inside. Played the game a ton, played countless hours of wiffle ball as a kid in the summers, all of that stuff. Those are great examples, very vivid, that communicate this point rather well. And I know Spanish. It's rather dormant now, having not been used really for the last couple of decades. But I lived in Mexico City for a year after college. I had studied Spanish in high school and undergrad, then lived in Mexico City. I worked in a bank for a real estate development company. The bank was our partner. And unfortunately, in a way, everyone there just wanted to use me to practice their English, but had enough friends and compatriots down there who were already beyond flawless, beyond bilingual, fully bicultural, like knew all the pop culture references, knew all the Eddie Murphy movies or whatever, completely. They didn't need to practice English at all, and they would help me practice and took further, like had a tutor and that kind of thing, and just continued to develop it. By the end of my time there, I could conduct business meetings entirely in Spanish, and I did achieve, I may have mentioned this before on one of these, I'm not sure, but I did achieve the switch where, one thing I'd always heard, these, once you know a language when you start to dream in the language, and I had a dream that recreated a scene from my childhood at Six Flags in front of the Judge Roy Scream roller coaster, some friends sitting in a circle, and that conversation, I realized while having the dream that the recreation was fully in Spanish. I was dreaming in Spanish, and I woke up bolt upright and was happy that that occurred. It was like a milestone. And I definitely remember the experience. At first, what I was an incredibly slow, bad translation machine. And for a long time, all that happened was I was speeding up the translation and finding more words that I could translate on the fly. Meaning, I might hear you speak in Spanish, and I would take your words in my mind and turn them into English. Think of my reply in English, translate my reply into Spanish, and speak Spanish. I was a translation machine. I definitely reached the point. I'm not exactly sure. How can I be sure what's actually going on deep down in thought? But I believe I reached the point where I quit even thinking the English words. I could see the environment around me, drive to work, and I could just think in Spanish. I could associate the objects in the world and emotions or whatever, what we do with language. I could use Spanish primarily. There was no translation occurring, or it didn't need to occur. And so I kind of can internalize that feeling and imagining that, you know, I've read here some stuff about Kobe and touched on a little bit of athletes. Kobe is this writer's example of Pavarotti and Willie Mays is apt. I mean, Kobe was otherworldly in his talent and also otherworldly in his dedication to training and honing his craft. Otherworldly. Even in standing on a court waiting for practice with the Olympic team, the best of the best, he had separated himself from those peers with his dedication. So in this language, the chunking that he had established in his fluency, by the way, the man apparently also was fluent in six languages. That's rather an interesting fact about him as well. So this idea of learning something, chunking it, breaking it down, and then being able, I think in this passage, Coyle cited a gymnast who's not able to think about each chunk anymore. It's just they can engage a whole sweep of actions that they've now honed through so much deliberate practice into a single movement. It's all really kind of in inspiring stuff. And the other thing I would say about language, just as a personal aside, it is the funniest feeling. I haven't traveled internationally a ton, but you know, been to France, a few places in France, for example, and I've been trying to think to a couple of other European places that don't speak where neither English nor Spanish are the primary languages. And this hilarious thing happens to me every time. My mind, it doesn't last long because I realize what's happening. It's so obvious. It's embarrassing in a way. It's funny. Someone will speak to me in French, and in my mind, the first time that happens, you know, let's say I flew to Paris today. I'm going to get off the airplane. I'm going to go, you know, get a taxi or whatever. When I interact with anybody and they speak French to me, my first response, the automatic response is internally, I think, oh, I know how to do this. I know how to speak not English. And I start speaking Spanish. It's happened several times. I just revert to Spanish because I spent that year in Mexico City, and that's my automatic response. It's like, cool, we're in not English world. And so of course it really doesn't work. They're like, what are you doing? And if they speak more than one language, they recognize my bad Spanish and they might try to speak English or whatever. I get over it very quickly. But it's a funny response. So it must be cool to be somebody like Kobe was, where you've got six entire systems, language systems, inside your mind. That's pretty cool. I'm not sure what that would be like to learn a third language. I've played around with Duolingo and, you know, gone into Italian or something, or French, and tried something like Japanese for just a little while, just because it's got a completely different sort of derivation and whatnot. And it's cool to hear it and see it, and Duolingo is such a good app. But regardless, the idea of language as a metaphor and chunking and all of that is really cool, and that it's a scientific concept related to skill acquisition is pretty great. Skill acquisition is an important idea. Education from K-12 through college, graduate school, isn't only about skill. There's also just knowledge. Going back to the Acton folks and Clark Aldrich and others talking about the three kinds of learning: learn to be, learn to do, learn to know. There is immense value in just knowledge, just knowing history and knowing things. But skill acquisition is incredibly important, and they obviously the three kinds of learning all can reinforce each other. And in the economy, if you have just pure knowledge, that can be incredibly lucrative. But it also, even however much knowledge you have, knowing how to do things with it is really critical. So Talent Code is awesome for each of us to imagine and to internalize the frameworks and try to focus on our own learning. And then what's cool about Culture Code is the same author starts applying his research and writing and elucidation of this stuff into groups of people, companies, and all kinds of different groups. And that is also fascinating stuff. That's enough for this morning, I think. I did get up before 5 just to share with you all that I did. Jocko Willink's Instagram watch photos style. I woke up at 4:45, which 5 minutes before the alarm was going to go off anyway. And I managed to get out of bed. I got quite a few things done this morning. I didn't record this right away, and I had a meeting at 7:30 that lasted till 8:30, so I knocked this out right after that. Hope y'all are doing great, and I will talk with you again tomorrow.